This program was recorded at InterVarsity's Following Christ Conference, held in Chicago, December 27th through 31st, 2008.
If you asked Francis Collins when he was a graduate student whether he could imagine the life he has now, the answer, like almost every speaker we've heard from, is a resounding no. First, at that time, he was a physical chemist studying quantum mechanics. Second, he was an atheist. Yet during his second year of graduate school, he realized there was something interesting about biology. Recombinant DNA meant medicine could conceivably prevent and treat diseases never thought of before. Francis got his PhD in 3 years and then went to medical school. In medical school, having assumed faith was something acquired on a merely emotional basis, he found that faith and reason went together and became a believer at age 27. Francis has achieved incredible success in his field, yet he sees his success as God-given. God opened doors he not only would never have dreamt of opening, but didn't even know existed. The word genome wasn't uttered until 1985. Yet within 4 years, his lab found the gene for cystic fibrosis, a feat that at the time was seen as impossible. And its accomplishment created new hope for curing all sorts of diseases. Francis was subsequently put in charge of the National Human Genome Project and served for 15 years as its director. Great things were accomplished in that time, but Francis worked hard, often 80 to 90 hour work weeks. He feels blessed that despite those hours, he has a great relationship with his wife, 2 daughters, and 5 grandchildren. Francis has since retired, but that doesn't mean God's call on his life and work have ended. He says God has given him the chance to articulate how science and faith can be put together when the larger culture doesn't believe it can be done. He's working on a book called Personalized Medicine, has created a foundation called the BioLogos Foundation that's compiled the top 33 questions about science and faith, along with answers, and will be online in 2 months. He's putting together a conference for select scientists, theologians, and pastors to develop a theology of celebration. He's volunteered as a missionary doctor in Africa, and in his free time, he's been asked to be on the Obama transition team. Francis's favorite Christmas memory was celebrating with his 3 grandchildren. It was delightful pandemonium. And his favorite drink is a Starbucks cinnamon dolce latte. Please welcome Francis Collins.
Thanks for that very kind introduction, and what a thrill it is for me to be here with all of you in this Following Christ conference to talk about human flourishing. My perspective on that, as you will see, is that science is a contributor to the way in which we can flourish, both because it satisfies our curiosity, God-given curiosity, I might say, about how the world works, but it also provides us with some possible solutions to the many problems that vex us and may actually put us in a better position to carry out Christ's exhortations in terms of reaching out to those who need our help. But science can also be a difficult topic when believers get together, because there are certainly many instances in which there are perceived conflicts between what science seems to be teaching us about how the universe works and what various interpretations of Scripture seem to say on those same matters. I'm here this evening to tell you that as a scientist and a believer and one who works in this field of genetics, which is in many ways one of the more difficult and explosive ones, that I have found absolutely no conflict at any point between what I know as a follower of Jesus Christ and what I've been able to learn about the science of how life works. And I want to try to walk you through what some of those accomplishments of many, many scientists around the world are teaching us and how they fit together with the faith that we are all here to share and talk about. In that regard, science is not a threat to faith. In fact, science, because it gives us a chance to learn more about God's creation, is a joyful form of worship. And that is my theme this evening, and I think it does fit with this overall theme of human flourishing. And I want to thank John Boyd for the careful way in which he instructed me about the kinds of things that might make the most sense at a gathering of this sort, and I look forward to being part of one of the groups at 9 o'clock talking about math and science. Matthew chapter 22, verses 36 and 37, here is a case where Jesus is being quizzed. "Teacher, which is the greatest commandment in the law?" You know the reply. Jesus replied, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind." Interesting. Go back to Deuteronomy where this seems to come from. Unless the translation is confusing me, I think mind was one that Jesus added, and that it was not as clearly there in the Old Testament version. So we are called to love the Lord our God with our minds, and those of you who are graduate students and faculty and playing other important roles in the life of the mind, I think would agree that this is a glorious opportunity for a believer. And yet many people out there in the larger world, they're a little uneasy about this. Are we going to get so carried away with our intellectual endeavors that we will forget to notice who's the author of it all? Well, I'm going to be talking about DNA. It's on my tie, after all. This marvelous molecule, and I know there's some of you that work on this every day and some who are in other fields for which it is not so familiar, but you can't help but be awed by the elegance of the DNA molecule. And the way in which it is the information-carrying source of life for all living beings. It has its information carried in a simple language. There's an etymology of DNA, Carmen. We should talk about that. It's a very simple one, but we're actually beginning to appreciate it's not that simple after all. It has just four letters in its alphabet, these four chemical bases, A, C, G, and T. And A, as you hopefully can see in this diagram, on one strand always pairs with T on the other, and G always matches up with C, which gives you a nice way to repair damage. If something happens to one strand, you can always fix it with the other one. And as Watson and Crick pointed out when they figured all this out back in 1953, this is also an elegant way to copy a DNA strand by unwinding it and using each strand as a template for a new one, and pretty soon you have two daughter strands that are identical to what you started with. The genome of an organization is all of its DNA. And there's a rough correlation, although with many exceptions, about complexity of the organism and how much DNA it needs to carry that out. We humans, our human genome, has to be pretty complicated. That would not seem to surprise you when you consider that the biological properties of a human being are pretty amazing. You were all once single cells, and here you are. And a lot of things had to happen to get from there to here. And they had to somehow be written into this rather simple four-letter alphabet code. So it is perhaps not too surprising that the human genome is big. How big? About 3 billion of those letters. Now in Washington, where I live, 3 billion is hardly anything at all anymore. Yeah. But if you're a cell and you've got to copy this thing every time you want to make a new cell, that's a lot of work to do. If we decided this evening, just because it would be fun, that we're going to read the human genome, and I asked each person to read a few letters and then pass it on to the next, and we'd stay here until we were done, because this is a moment. We're going to read God's language here. Well, your various endeavors would take, I'm afraid, a bad hit, because we would be forced to stay here 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, for 31 years. To get that done, just the information that you have inside one of your cells. Amazing system. And it's a system which we are learning a prodigious amount about, and which is the source of great excitement for those of us who work in this field. So DNA is an instruction book. It's a pretty good metaphor. It really is. Sitting inside the cell of each of the cells of your body, carrying out instructions that are appropriate for that cell and maybe not for another. So it's kind of tricky there, because the same instruction book is in your liver and in your blood cells and in your brain, and yet different instructions have to be used in those different situations. The whole concept of gene regulation, which we are also learning a lot about right now, but which is really quite complicated, maybe even more complicated than anybody imagined. Well, the Human Genome Project was thought about, discussed, debated. Most scientists actually opposed to it at the outset. Got underway in 1990 with the goal of reading out all 3 billion of those letters and also studying some model organisms along the way, partly for practice and partly to try to figure out how we were going to interpret all this. I was asked to come and lead it in 1993 after this effort had been underway for just 3 years. And it was pretty unclear whether the promise of delivering on this project by 2005 had even the faintest chance of success because the technology hadn't been invented yet to make this possible. There were some challenging days back then. I had a little motto on my wall from Winston Churchill for those bad days, and it said, "When you're going through hell, keep going." Consider the alternative, right? So we kept going, and blessedly, we recruited some of the best and brightest scientists of the current generation to join this effort because it was such a sense of history that we would only have to do this once for all time. We could read out the human instruction book, put it into the public domain, which was one of our promises, and get it done, and then begin to try to understand how this works and how sometimes it doesn't work and disease occurs. Who wouldn't want to be part of that? And a lot of people signed up, even recognizing that they weren't necessarily going to get a lot of individual credit. And ultimately, I served as the field general, if you will, for a scientific enterprise that involved about 2,500 scientists in 6 countries, 20 laboratories. The sun never went down on the genome project. And happily, it worked. And it even worked ahead of schedule and under budget, which in Washington, D.C. is unheard of. So we got done, not in 2005, but in April 2003, very conveniently, and not completely by accident, but mostly, in the 50th anniversary month of Watson and Crick's paper describing that double helix. So there we had it. But of course, we had to figure out what it meant. And there were lots of publications about it. Time magazine put a big cover story out, Solving the Mysteries of DNA. You will notice that they have double helices here, but they also have Adam and Eve, which is interesting that already in this context of the cover of Time magazine, the question's being subtly portrayed about whether, in fact, there is a problem here or whether this is an illumination or whether they just figure magazines sell better with naked people on the cover. I think there may be something to that one. So since 2003, with that foundation in place, genome science has been rocketing off in all sorts of interesting directions to try to understand how the genome works, and particularly to apply this for medical benefit. And one of the major areas of interest since 2003 is to try to understand the differences between our individual genomes. Now, mind you, they're awfully similar. My DNA and yours, regardless of which of you I pick, we are 99.6% the same. But of those differences, most of them probably don't matter very much. There are a few that place me at risk of something and you at risk for something else. And as a physician, this is one of the exciting parts of the project, is to begin to figure out how that works so that we could begin the process of giving people better information about how to stay healthy. And just in the last couple of years, we have gone from knowing only a handful of the genetic risk factors for diabetes and heart disease and cancer and asthma and high blood pressure and all those conditions that fill up our hospitals and clinics to now knowing more than 800 of them. A just big deluge of discovery has happened here. Now, how does that help us? Well, it is going to, and already is in many instances, change the face of medicine according to this diagram. Imagine you're going from top to bottom. I haven't labeled the time axis because each disease will be a little different, and I don't know how long it's going to take. We're starting, though, with this process of identifying genetic risk factors for diseases using the tools from the Human Genome Project. Now, in some instances, like some cancers, for instance, it is already possible then to predict who's at high risk for that cancer. Colon cancer is a great example, and make sure that person gets into a program of careful surveillance in order to prevent a bad outcome, because cancer starts as a benign process, and if you can catch it while it's still benign, you've done something really good. There's also the possibility to identify risk factors that make a difference in terms of who gets a good response from a drug and who doesn't. Today's New York Times has a big story about a woman with breast cancer who was given a drug that was supposed to prevent the cancer from coming back, and ultimately it turned out that she's genetically resistant to that drug and she should have taken something else. And we're starting to learn about that so that we can individualize treatments. And in the longer term, because this is the slowest part because it takes a lot of studies and clinical trials, we're going to revolutionize treatments. The way in which we treat most diseases, well, frankly, it's kind of empirical the way we've arrived at those decisions. We could do better than that. If we really understand the molecular basis of what pathway it is that we need to fix, then we can come up with gene therapies or drug therapies that do that, and you can already see that happening in some cases of cancer in a truly dramatic way. So medicine is going to be turned upside down in the next 10 or 15 years, and hooray for that, because we really need to see that revolution, and we need to spread it around the world and not just keep it in the hands of the developed world where we have so many resources. And that would certainly be one of the things I hope to be part of in the coming years. So that's a little riff on my medical circumstances and my scientific interests. But how does this all fit together with faith? I like these two diagrams placed side by side because they kind of make you think about this a little bit. On the left is the rose window of Westminster Cathedral, a beautiful stained glass spiritual representation. On the right, what is that? Well, that's DNA. That's an interesting view of DNA. Instead of looking at it from the side, you're looking down the barrel of that double helix, and so it gives you this beautiful radial pattern. Now, I'm not suggesting there's something cosmic here. But I am suggesting that looking at those images is a useful way to contemplate the question that we, I think, are going to focus on here for the next few minutes, which is there are two worldviews here. There's a spiritual worldview, and there's a scientific worldview. And there are a lot of people out there arguing that you've got to have a choice. You can only have one of those. That if you're going to be a scientist, you've got to give up that spiritual stuff because it's not really rigorous thinking. And if you're going to be spiritual, you better not trust science because it may mislead you. Now, I'm here to say I think that is a very unfortunate perspective, and yet you can hear it on the airwaves and read it in the bookshelves, even some of the books over there, that are making this argument in a way that I think in the long run is going to be damaging to us and to our faith and to our science. So how do we get around this? Well, first of all, let me tell you a little bit about my own story. As it was mentioned, I was an atheist when I was a graduate student in physical chemistry. I got there sort of slowly. I was not raised in a home where faith was considered very important. It wasn't denigrated, but it certainly wasn't practiced by my parents. When I got to college, I still had some inklings of that, and maybe occasionally they sort of spilled out of me, but I wasn't really quite sure what I was talking about when I got to that perspective, and there were always atheists around who could quickly shoot down my arguments. And by the time I got to graduate school, I decided they were right. And I kind of liked that conclusion because it meant I wasn't responsible to any other outside holy entity that maybe wouldn't approve of all the things that I was doing anyway. I had the sort of willful blindness approach to faith that C.S. Lewis talks about. But then I changed directions and decided to go to medical school, as you heard in the introduction, attracted by the science that was happening there and a growing need within myself to do something where I would have more interactions directly with human beings who might need some help. And in medical school, all those hypothetical questions about life and death became very non-hypothetical. They were very real. One afternoon, as I sat at the bedside of a patient who I had become quite fond of because she reminded me of my grandmother, a woman with very severe cardiac disease who clearly had run out of options. We really weren't able to manage her severe chest pain at all well. And in that afternoon, after a bad episode of chest pain, she shared her faith with me about how her faith in Jesus gave her confidence that she would be able to handle whatever came along, and she was not afraid of death. She was peaceful about it. She looked forward to being enfolded in the arms of her Savior. And I was kind of embarrassed because I didn't know what to say. And she picked up on that and looked at me finally and said, "You know, doctor, I've just told you about my faith, but you haven't said anything. What do you believe, doctor?" Wow. Nobody ever asked me that question in such a setting, so sincerely, looking me straight in the eye. And I stammered and stuttered, and somehow the idea of saying, "Well, I don't believe any of it," not only seemed impolite, it seemed like I wasn't really sure that was what the answer was supposed to be. And I got out of the room as fast as I could and then felt this growing disquiet about what happened there and why was that so unsettling and what was it about this simple question, "What do you believe, doctor," that threw me for a loop. And I realized after a while what the problem was. I was pretty proud of myself of being somebody who used reason to come up with answers. That's what science does. And I'd arrived at the answer, is there a God, without really using the powers of reason to try to come up with arguments pro and con. I kind of liked the con arguments, took them within me, and that was that. And I realized there were people around me, pretty substantive people, some of my professors in medical school who were believers. And they must have some reason. Maybe it's just not all childhood indoctrination. Maybe there's something there. So I better find out about that so that I'm not going to be put on the spot again. Because I sure didn't like that. So I knocked on the door of a Methodist minister who lived down the street from me, who seemed like a reasonable person. And I figured I could ask him questions and he wouldn't throw me out. So I asked him a lot of questions that were probably pretty blasphemous, actually. And he patiently listened and answered a couple of the simpler ones and said, you know, you're starting into a journey here where I think you could use some help from somebody who's traveled that same path. I'm going to give you a book that was written by an Oxford scholar who was an atheist and who found he had friends who were believers, and he tried to figure out why, and he wrote about it. So why don't you read this and maybe we can talk about it later. And he took a little book off his shelf and gave it to me, and I took it home. And it didn't sound too threatening. Yeah, it had the word Christianity in it, but it was prefaced by mere, which made it made it sound like maybe it was a put-down, and maybe that would be all right. Well, of course, you know who wrote that. That was C.S. Lewis, and that amazing book, which to this day is the book I give to skeptics who are questioning how faith and reason could possibly go together, caught me right where I was. And by goodness, by the third page, I realized that all of my arguments against faith were those of a schoolboy, and they lay quickly in ruins at the logical, persuasive hand of this Oxford scholar who seemed to be able to read my mind, because every time I came up with an objection to what was on page 12, he answered it on page 13. It was really spooky. And so I realized that this wasn't going to do, that I really had to investigate this more thoroughly, that I couldn't dismiss faith as superstition. There was something there. And that faith and reason were, in fact, capable of working together. Well, I'll skip over a lot of what happened in the next 2 years and simply tell you that, because it was a 2-year effort to try to make sense out of this, that I gradually began to realize that some of the arguments that point most strongly to the existence of a God who's outside of nature came from nature itself, from science, after all. And here are a few of them. The obvious, but maybe not so obvious one, that there is something instead of nothing. There's no reason that should be so. Wigner's phrase, the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics. Here I had spent my PhD doing second-order differential equations to try to describe matter and energy. Never occurred to me to really think about, why should that work? Why is it that a theory, when you really got it right, is beautiful and simple instead of ugly and complicated? What is that about? The fact that the universe had a beginning cries out for an explanation. The Big Bang, well, what came before that? Well, you can come up with various theories, some of which require a lot of faith. But one theory that seemed the most straightforward, if you want to apply Occam's razor, is that there was a single beginning and that, in fact, the universe arose out of nothingness. Well, nature doesn't do that, right? So you have to then postulate a creator who's not part of nature. Otherwise, you've fallen into the infinite regress problem. Well, that sounds like God. And that means that God must be outside of time and space, and in fact created time as well as space. Those all made sense to me all of a sudden. And then we look at the way in which the universe is put together and the precise tuning of those physical constants that control the way matter and energy behave. Constants that you cannot derive by theory. They just have the value they have, and we've determined that experimentally. But which we are realizing, particularly in the last 40 years, are precisely set in a particular place so that some kind of complexity of the universe is possible. And if they deviated by even one part in a billion from their current value, there would be no possibility except an infinitely expanding or contracting sterile universe. There's at least 15 of those constants. And you can't look at that information and say, well, it's just good luck. It either has to be that somebody set those values, some deity outside of the process, or you have to go to this other hypothesis that there's a multitude of universes, almost an infinite number, and of course we have to exist in the one where we won the lottery and everything turned out right. Now, which of those two theories seems the most simple and beautiful? Seemed to me a creator made a lot more sense. But so far, we've only got to deism, haven't we? There's nothing here that talks about humans. So what about that? Well, this is the first chapter of Lewis's book. Remember that? Right and wrong as a clue to the meaning of the universe. Sounded a little grandiose to me when I first saw that one, but you know, this is about the moral law. Where is it that we get this idea that there's such a thing as right and wrong? And it seems to be universal across histories and cultures. We have a different idea, depending on our cultural experiment, about what we put in the category called right and what we put in the category called wrong. But we don't disagree that those categories exist and that we're supposed to do the right thing. And when we don't, we immediately prove that we believe in the law by making an excuse. Have you noticed that? People say, I don't believe in that morality stuff. As soon as you ask them to do something or charge them with doing something that seems a little off color, they make an excuse. Well, I had a bad day. You know, that person spoke to me mean first. Okay, you just proved the law. Now, what about this? There are those who will argue, and there are lots of them, that this is, in fact, an evolutionary consequence. That we humans, by developing this sense of right and wrong, we're better able to conduct ourselves in terms of social interactions, and that the only thing that evolution cared about, reproductive fitness, was benefited as a result. And you can put together pretty interesting models, and Martin Nowak at Harvard has done a lot of really elegant work here, using things like a variation on the prisoner's dilemma in order to come up with arguments that kind of evolutionary mechanism might account for generosity to other people, even outside your own family. But they always require you to be hostile to people outside your own group. You can't get away with that part. But in many ways, that's the part of the moral law that when we see it in action, we most marvel and we most think, that's how we should be. The Good Samaritan, Oscar Schindler, saving the Jews from the Holocaust, people he didn't know, people not of his own group. Or this guy, Wesley Autry, African-American construction worker standing on the side of the subway platform in New York City, watched with alarm as a young graduate student standing nearby had an epileptic seizure and fell off the platform into the tracks in front of an oncoming train. There was no time to pull him out, but Wesley nonetheless jumped into the tracks, covered the young man with his own body, wedging both of them between the tracks as the train rumbled over them. And miraculously, both survived with just enough clearance for their two bodies not to be crushed. So the next day, everybody's asking, Wesley, what were you doing? And he's simply describing his own version of the moral law. I saw somebody in trouble. I knew it could be life ending for me, but it was the right thing to do. And the whole world agreed. Evolution won't get you there. That was a scandal to evolution, what Wesley did. And if you're willing to go there with me, then in fact, I think we have this kind of an argument from our own observation about the need to postulate a holy God who calls us also to be holy. That was pretty powerful, me. But then I had to figure out what faith made the most sense, because I didn't have a grounding in any particular world religion. I studied them and seemed like, to my relief, they had a lot in common. And that made me feel like there's some real truth there, all that stuff in common, but they had differences too. And you know what did it for me? Was as this moral law loomed larger for me, the sense of being called to do the right thing, to be good and holy, I was more and more aware of how much I fell short of that. And just as God began to appear as a reality, God was retreating from me because of my own failures. And as I studied the world religions trying to figure out what they had to say about this, I encountered the person of Jesus Christ, who not only claimed to know about God, but claimed to be God, and who died on the cross for me because I needed a Savior to bridge that yawning gap between my imperfections and God's holiness. And suddenly it all made sense. And on a beautiful fall day in the Cascade Mountains, hiking, one of those days where everything gets pushed aside and you can actually focus on what really matters for a few hours, I realized I had no more resistance, and I didn't want any more resistance, and I fell on my knees and gave my life to Christ. I was 27. It took me a while. Well, you might say, That should have been more obvious. After all, look at the definition of faith, Hebrews 11. Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Evidence. But you might say, don't you have a problem now? You're a believer and you're already into genetics. Doesn't your head explode when you try to put this all together? And in particular, isn't evolution incompatible with faith? So do you not believe in evolution? Do you believe in evolution? How do you put that together with faith? Well, just for fun, I'll give you an example of one of the conversations that happens when evolution and faith find themselves in the same room. In this particular case, it was a bit of an inquisition. And the inquisitor was somebody that you may have seen on late night television. So maybe we can put up that particular video and have a look at the outcome of this particular point. Just about 2 years ago.
My guest tonight is a DNA expert and the author of The Language of God. Sorry, doctor. God doesn't speak DNA. He speaks English. Please welcome Dr. Francis Collins. Doctor, thanks for coming on.
A pleasure to be here.
You ready to take the heat, man?
I'm ready. Hit me.
I'm going to pop you in the Colbert autoclave and sterilize your ideas. Ooh. All right, look it up. Now, you got a book here. I'm going to get right to it, okay? Let's move some paper. It's called The Language of God, all right? A scientist presents evidence for belief. Wait. Science and belief. You're a scientist, you believe in that science stuff, and you're a Christian.
Correct.
Okay?
Absolutely correct.
Are you going to be the only Christian in hell? Because you believe in evolution, all that stuff, right? Like me, monkey man.
Well, you know, actually some 40% of working scientists are also believers in a personal God who answers prayer. Sounds a bit like your God, too. So I guess I'll have company if we're all down there. But you know what? I don't think we will be. Where do you think we got the ability to do science?
You misused God's gifts. You questioned God rather than being obedient to his word.
No.
Okay.
This is an ability to see God's creation in all of its awesome glory. Mm-hmm. For us to be able to appreciate that is
right.
A way to worship him, is it not? Right. And I don't know why you're so upset.
No, it is not. Well, I mean, if you want my opinion, if you're asking me to render judgment here, and I judge not, lest I be judged.
Yes, I can
see
that.
Don't chap and verse me, man. I don't think that we need to question what happens in the world. We just live our lives, you know. I mean, I wish we were all still shepherds. Why do you think that the beauty of the world and God's creation can be revealed through science? Like, well, show me what is this thing? Is it a merry-go-round?
Well, it will rotate, but it's not exactly a merry-go-round. So this is DNA. This is the stuff of life. This is the information molecule of all living organisms. And this is, in my view, also the way that God spoke life into being. As a believer who's also somebody who studies this stuff, seems to me there's something pretty profound here.
All right, I'll bite. All right. What day did you do this on? You believe that God created the world in 7 days. Everything in 7 days, 6 days, and 7 day rested. Or are there parts of the Bible you don't accept?
I think there are parts of the Bible that maybe weren't intended to be absolutely literally interpreted. I mean, those 7 days.
Like maybe God loves and forgives everyone like you? Okay?
I want that part to be true.
We all want that part to be true. You throw out any part of the Bible, sir, throw out all of it.
Well,
okay?
How long were those days, those first three, before there was a sun?
You see this watch? You see the little hand?
Mm-hmm.
It goes around twice. That's a day. You're supposed to be one of these smartiacs, and you don't... That's a day.
So, Stephen, I think you need to understand something about evolution, which seems to be such an enemy to you. Evolution is your friend. You don't have to be dismayed about evolution.
We all have imaginary friends, but we grow out of it.
But evolution is really God's plan for giving upgrades. You're a fruit fly. It doesn't work so well. You need to do more than that. You're a mammal, but you still have that thumb that isn't in the right place. Uh-huh. Upgrade. You need a bigger brain in order to be able to have your intelligence.
Upgrade.
You need language.
Upgrade. No.
This is evolution. We're still in evolution.
But that doesn't evolution imply that God makes mistakes? Like, weren't the dinosaurs a big oops-a-daisy?
They were pretty cool while they were around.
Yeah, but God said, enough of that. That implies someday we could be extinct, and I don't buy that.
Well, they needed to get the dinosaurs out of the way so you'd have your chance, you know. If they hadn't gone extinct, I don't think us mammals would have had a niche to sort of land in. So I don't think you ought to be too unhappy about that particular outcome.
Now, you are the head of the Human Genome Project, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So can we, let's get into the science here for a second.
Let's do that.
Are we going to be able to patent genes? Am I going to be able to say, I own my genes? Because I know people are going to want to copy.
Well, people, and I can see why that would be. But
I already sell a lot of Formula 401, and I want to make sure that I'm not going to get cloned.
Mm. Well, I think you're okay on this, because any genes that haven't already been patented can't be, because we put all of the DNA sequence in the public domain, and now it's called prior art, and nobody can claim it. That was one of the goals of the Human Genome Project, is to stop all this patenting of fundamental information about our own genome.
Now, Genome Project, you read the entire DNA of human beings,
all
correct?
3 billion of the letters that you see there. In fact, I brought you along here. That's a DVD that has all 3 billion of those letters. You can take it home and start reading through them. A, C, G, T, G, G, T, C, C, etc.
Did you read all 3 billion, or did you skip over some of them, like the whale chapter in Moby Dick? is there a Cliff Notes for this?
You know, that's a really good question. There were people who proposed the idea of skipping over the stuff that they thought was junk, but you know, I don't think we're smart enough to know what was junk, and I bet you'd agree with that, since it's God's language.
Do you believe in cloning?
Cloning as defined by human, reproductive cloning?
Yeah, taking a bit of somebody and making another of that person.
No, I think that's a very bad thing to do.
That's too bad, because I was hoping the one good thing that could come out of this Human Genome Project was you, as a Christian, go to Turin, get some of Jesus off the shroud and make another.
You know, somebody tried to get a little bit of that cloth and see if they could get DNA out of it and ask the question, what's the DNA of God? But you know what? The shroud turned out to be a little too recent.
Mm-hmm. For those of little faith.
Well,
for me, it's still very old. Doctor, thank you for stopping by. Dr. Francis Collins and the Human Genome. We'll be right back.
Well, I'm sure Tom Wright would agree that being in that particular chair is a white-knuckled experience, if there ever was one. When he came out to the green room to say hello to me, I figured Colbert would at least engage in a little bit of a conversation about what kinds of questions he might ask. Oh, no. He simply came out and said, oh, are you that Dr. Collins? And I had to admit I was. And he said, I'm going to get you. You're going to go down. And that was it. That was the interview. Okay, well, let's try to put this in context, because despite the humor in that, and there was quite a bit, and boy, that guy is clever, this is an issue that I think troubles a lot of people, not just Stephen playing Stephen Colbert, but what really is the evidence for the theory of evolution, and if there is evidence, how do we put that together with what the Bible tells us about creation? I'm just going to show you one piece of evidence, and I could show you hours of this, that convinced me that the idea of descent from a common ancestor is correct, and that that includes human beings. And for us to argue otherwise, with all of the data that now is in front of us, much of it coming from the study of DNA, is perhaps to put ourselves in a circumstance where we're on a collision course with the truth. And I don't think God would ask us to do that. Here is that one example. Here are three genes with funny names. In the human and the cow and the mouse, those three genes happen to be in the same order, and they're similar enough to each other that a computer can quickly pick them out as being related. But I picked this one particular one for a reason, and that is because the gene called GULO, which stands for galunolactone oxidase, actually has a huge deletion in the middle of it, hence this gravestone RIP. It's a pseudogene. It no longer is capable of making a protein. Well, why does that matter? Well, it mattered if you were a sailor on a ship and you didn't have citrus around, because that's the enzyme, or it's the gene that codes for the enzyme, that's necessary to make ascorbic acid. Cows and mice can make ascorbic acid. We cannot, because that gene doesn't work. Apparently, it doesn't matter so much, except in some special circumstances, so we've gotten along. But look at that diagram. If God had in fact created human beings as a special act of creation and not as part of this long tapestry of derivation from a common ancestor, would God have inserted a non-functioning gene in exactly the place where common ancestry would predict it to lie? I think if you are going to argue that, you almost have to say that God was trying to deceive us, and I don't care for that particular strategy in terms of how it fits with everything else we know about God the Creator. And I could give many other examples. And I know this is something that troubles people in this audience and many in the church. Darwin's idea about common ancestry is now incontrovertibly right. But be not afraid. This is no threat. One question, of course, that one can then ask is, okay, so common descent is correct. What about biological complexity? And, of course, that is the argument particularly coming from intelligent design. And the favorite example, and a very interesting one, is the bacterial flagellum, this amazing little outboard motor that bacteria use to zip around in a liquid solution, which has no less than 32 different proteins that make up this motor structure. And if you knock out any one of those 32 proteins, the whole thing stops working. So the argument from Philip Johnson and William Dembski and Michael Behe and others is that evolution couldn't possibly have put that all together, because you would have to develop by pure chance the first 31 of those proteins with no benefit attached to that at all, until finally one day the 32nd one fell into place and you got something useful. And evolution mathematically could never accomplish that. And I think that is a compelling argument until you start looking at it more closely. But as you look at it more closely, and people now have, and I would encourage people who are interested in reading more about this to read this article in Nature Reviews Microbiology, it turns out those 32 proteins didn't arise out of nowhere. They all in other organisms can be found to have other roles. And it's clear that what's happened here is a gradual, step-by-step accumulation of additional proteins, giving a slightly better tweak to the function, until ultimately you get something that looks like this E. coli flagellum, which is the poster child for ID. And as Dembski himself has said, if so-called irreducible complexity turns out to be accountable by simple stepwise processes that natural selection could have produced, then ID would have to be considered as no longer a useful hypothesis. I'm not sure the ID folks want to say that that point has been arrived at, but I think it has. And in that regard, I fear, and I say this with great love and concern about the church, because the church has in many ways embraced ID as a way of fighting off godless evolution. But if you've embraced a theory which is a god of the gaps, which ID runs the risk of being, and those gaps start to get filled in by science, which they now are, then have you helped the situation, or have you basically made things worse? This is a hard, kind of difficult part of our conversation, but I think especially here with all of you engaged in academic pursuits in science and the humanities and many other fields, we have to talk about this. Okay, you might say then, if you're going to shoot down ID and if you're going to support descent from a common ancestor, where is there any room left for God? Well, certainly that argument has been made by some like Dawkins, who would say, okay, that does it. There's no more need for God. Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, one of those rare books that doesn't need a subtitle, makes this case in a very passionate and personal way, but actually deviates from Dawkins' own precious attention to logic, in that he's applying arguments from nature to try to fit them to the God hypothesis, when in fact, if God has any meaning, God has to be at least in part outside of nature, and therefore science is the wrong set of tools to try to answer the question. And in that regard, Chesterton, having already been quoted once this evening by Carmen, has something to say about atheism in the same way. It's the most daring of all dogmas, the assertion of a universal negative, something that we generally avoid doing in other situations. If you want to read more about this debate about atheism versus faith, I have I had such a debate with Richard Dawkins, and that was published in Time a couple of years ago, and it's still up on the web. And I would encourage you to give that to people who think that Dawkins has all the answers, because quite a number of chips in his arguments appear during the course of that conversation, including at the end him saying, well, you know, there might be something actually outside of nature that is supernatural and grand and powerful, but it would be so much grander and more powerful than anything you've ever imagined that you believers would just be blown away by it. And I said, you got it at last. So how then can evolution and faith be reconciled? I want to come to this, and then we're going to wind this up. Actually, those 40% of scientists who are believers, like me, many of them have arrived at this conclusion without being quite sure that anybody else had ever thought of it, because once it comes to you, it seems so straightforward. And it goes like this. Almighty God, who is not limited in space or time, created a universe, we think, 13.7 billion years ago, with its parameters precisely tuned to allow the development of complexity over long periods of time. The universe was pregnant with possibilities from the beginning, and that was intended. God's plan included the mechanism of evolution. Who are we to say that was a dumb idea? What an incredibly creative plan that was. To create this marvelous diversity of living things on our planet, and most especially, that plan specifically included the appearance of human beings in God's image. After evolution had done its work of preparing a house, if you will, the human brain, which had to reach a certain point of complexity before spirituality would have a home to live in, then God gifted humanity with the knowledge of good and evil, the moral law, with free will, and with the soul. And that, to me, is what the story of Adam and Eve is all about. And we humans, represented by Adam and Eve, used our free will to break that moral law, leading to our estrangement from God right from the beginning. But as I said, for me, and I suspect for many of you who've come to this same realization about the special place that Christ holds of all the world's religions, Christ provides the solution to that estrangement by dying on the cross for us. Now, theistic evolution is often used to describe this view, but it turns a lot of people off. It makes evolution to be the noun, theistic the adjective, as if somehow theistic's not that important, and many people aren't quite sure what theistic means anyhow. So let's try an alternative and go to the Greek bios, meaning life. Through God speaking us into being, logos, the word, or simply biologos. That seems to capture what I'm trying to say and what many scientists have arrived at, that life is this incredible gift, but there's a giver. Life is an incredible creation, but there's a creator. Life through the word. In the beginning was the word, John 1. The main conflict that many people will raise to this is, does this fit with the book of Genesis? You heard Colbert in a mocking sort of way put words out there that many people would feel quite sincerely need to be addressed. How does this fit with what we read in Genesis 1 and 2? Well, if you haven't recently read Genesis 1 and 2, maybe look at them tonight or tomorrow morning, and you will notice there are two creation stories, and they don't quite agree in terms of the order of appearance of plants and humans, for instance. I think we were supposed to notice that, because that would say that an ultra-literal interpretation cannot be sustained if you already, by the time you get to Genesis 2:7, have two different descriptions that can't quite be put together. So where did we get this idea? And it's a recent idea in the last 150 years. That there's only one interpretation of Genesis that's acceptable for a serious Christian. And that is what's, of course, taught in many of our churches and Sunday schools. There's only one acceptable way, and that is 6 24-hour days of creation. I wish that people would go back and read the words of Augustine, written 1,600 years ago, specifically about Genesis. Augustine was really fixated on Genesis, wrote 4 books about it. And here is his sort of most quoted and I think most wonderful summary, and it's a warning to all of us down through the centuries to pay attention to. Writing specifically about Genesis and the creation story, he says, in matters that are so obscure and far beyond our vision, We find in Holy Scripture passages which can be interpreted in very different ways without prejudice to the faith we have received. In such cases, we should not rush in headlong and so firmly take our stand on one side that a further progress in the search for truth justly undermines this position. Sounds like maybe scientific developments. We too fall with it. If we would, in fact, heed that warning, I think we could step away from what currently seems like a battle between scientists putting forward truth about nature and believers saying, wait a minute, that doesn't fit with what I thought Genesis meant or what somebody told me once it should mean. Augustine is giving us a lot of opportunity here to have that conversation more productively. If you want to read more about these perspectives, my book's been mentioned, but please also look this wonderful book by Daryl Falk, Coming to Peace with Science, published by InterVarsity. Daryl's a biology professor at Point Loma Nazarene, a wonderful believer who's also very sincere and loving in his approach to this in terms of reaching out to particularly evangelicals who are troubled by what evolution seems to be saying. And just this past summer, another wonderful book by Carl Giberson, who teaches partly at Gordon College and partly at Eastern Nazarene, called Saving Darwin, How to Be a Christian and Believe in Evolution. Both of these deeply thoughtful and very helpful. And for those of you who don't know and who are interested in science, the American Scientific Affiliation is the major organization in the United States of Christians who are scientists. That's their website. They run meetings. They have a journal. They provide a fellowship of scientist believers that I found very helpful when I discovered it in 1978 and find it helpful even today. So science isn't in conflict with faith. It can be a form of worship. Those worldviews can be put together in a way that is harmonious, that's complementary, that allows me as a scientist, when I have that wonderful moment of discovery, to not only say in a purely human way, wow, that's something new, but also to see that as a glimpse of God's mind. Sometime in the next 2 or 3 months, at this website, www.biologos.org, we'll try to post those 33 frequently asked questions for which draft answers are being scoured right now to be sure we haven't committed any heresies. And we'll put those up there in a way that I hope will be useful to you as you encounter those questions in yourself, in your family, or in your friends. So with that, I want to try to conclude this actually with a bit of a risky endeavor. But Carmen encouraged me because she started her presentation with a song. So I think we should end this one with a song. Now I'm going to need help from the person who's running the projector back there, since I have stepped away. Thank you. This is a familiar tune, a familiar hymn tune, Hifredal. The words to this, which I want you to pay very close attention to, because they are truly beautiful and truly appropriate for what we've just been talking about, are written by Reverend Thomas Troger, who is now on the faculty at the Yale Divinity School. Oh, and by the way, I just got this guitar a month ago. And it's, as you can see, a bit of vanity. That is a double helix on the fretboard. And if you look closely, at the top of the double helix is the sign of the fish. So maybe you could stand up and sing this with me. I know you all can sing. I heard you.
Source of faith and learning that has sparked and stoked the mind with a passion for discerning how the world has been designed. Let the sense of wonder flow from survey, keep our faith.
Let's take it on you all.